Hi, I have a proclamation I'd like to read you. We, the Native Americans, reclaim this land known as Alcatraz Island in the name of all American Indians by right of discovery. We wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with the Caucasian inhabitants of this land and hereby offer the following treaty. We will purchase said Alcatraz Island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth, a precedent set by the white man's purchase of a similar island about 300 years ago. We know that $24 in trade goods for these 16 acres is more than was paid when Manhattan Island was sold, but we know that land values have risen over the years. Our offer of $1.24 per acre is greater than 47 cents per acre the white man is now paying the California Indians for their land. We will give to the inhabitants of this island a portion of that land for their own, to be held in trust by the American Indian government. For as long as the sun shall rise and the rivers go down to the sea, to be administered by the Bureau of Caucasian Affairs.
Richard, you're presenting this to me now.
Yes, sir. We will further guide the inhabitants in the proper way of living. We will offer them our religion, our education, our life ways, in order to help them achieve our level of civilization and thus raise them and all their white brothers up from their savage and unhappy state. We offer this treaty in good faith and wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with all white men.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of American History 2. My name is Mark McClay and I'm joined, as always, by Malcolm Craig. Hello, Malcolm.
So yes, good morning, Mark, and we're delighted to be welcoming Rita Humalayoki, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the John Morton Centre for North American Studies at the University of Turku in Finland. So welcome, Rita, and could you tell us a little bit about your area of research?
Yeah, thanks, Mark and Malcolm. It's great to be on the podcast. So at the minute, I'm actually working on two projects. One is finishing off turning my PhD into a book. So that was on the language surrounding the U.S. policy of termination, which ran from 1953 to 1970. So I look at the discussions in tribal councils, Congress, and in the national press. And then the second project, which I, since moving to Turku in September, have started up, is on the formation of indigenous organizations in the U.S. and Canada in the Cold War era. So they're kind of interlinked, but two different projects I'm working on now.
Yeah, how very ambitious. I always find one's enough, but fair enough. So this podcast in some ways, I mean, obviously it's a slightly different topic, but it's sort of a second part to our chat that we had with Ed Mayer on Native Americans, and his focus was slavery, obviously, whereas yours is a wee bit more around how the federal government was dealing with Native Americans. And we left off with him in the middle of the 19th century. And I think it'd be wise just to, before we get to your area of expertise in the 1950s onwards and the era of termination, to sort of guide the listener through the broad story of the Native American experience, especially with the US government from the Civil War era onwards, even before we reach the 20th century. And I think that's because, especially in the public imagination, and I'm sure, I don't know, you might tell us, in reality, the final 40 years of the 19th century are incredibly consequential for Native Americans. I mean, in my own very limited understanding, I associate these years with the sort of famous headline events, such as, you know, Custer's Last Stand, you know, rare defeat for the Americans, and the massacre at Wounded Knee, a clear defeat for the Native Americans. But from reading some of the material you sent us prior to this podcast, that appears that the federal government wasn't just engaged in hunting down Native Americans, they were in fact trying a variety of different approaches to deal with them. And to try and sum these up, I wanted to borrow an approach I like to use with my students, if you don't mind, which is, you know, what kind of three words would you use to characterize the Native-Federal relationship in these years?
Well, if I may, I would actually rather just use two words, and that would be the concept of settler colonialism, which I think is a really important concept that's most recent or fairly recently been introduced into U.S. history, borrowed from Canada and Australia, for instance. And it really characterizes the whole relationship of the federal government and, rather settlers or the federal government later on, and Native Americans from the colonial period until the present. Like it's still an ongoing process. It's best described by the late Australian theorist Patrick Wolfe as a process which seeks to destroy to replace. So removing Indigenous peoples, whether violently or via other means, in order to make space for this new, or not so new in the case of today, this kind of settler state, or the US. So in this period, in the late 19th century, what we can see is kind of a shift away from those violent extermination tactics to make more space for the US to expand to kind of, a different approach, shall we say, an attempt to civilize the American Indians, to integrate them into this wider U.S. public via varying means of establishing farms or boarding schools, banning cultural practices, kind of making them into Americans to bring them into this wider U.S. Republic. So that's a shift that you can see in that period from those violent conflicts to a different approach.
Okay, and I just wanted to pick up on something you said there, the whole assimilation approach. How did that differ from, you know, we talked with Ed last time out about, you know, the early 19th century, how there were these sporadic efforts. Was it the fact that it was just now a full government effort that made it different, or were there other differences in the assimilation?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, assimilation had been attempted in varying degrees by states and colonial authorities priorly, but at this stage, it becomes an actual official policy of the federal government. So that's where we see the change with the laws that are passed in that period and kind of putting an end, for instance, to treaty making and to those those violent wars that were so criticized by the U.S. general public.
Cool. Yeah, and to pick up on, you know, you mentioned treaty making there. And one of the stats and the things you sent us that shocked me, and I don't know why it shocked me, it probably shouldn't, was the fact that the U.S. enters into 800 separate treaties with Native Americans, and yet it only ratifies 370 of them, but it violates every single one of those treaties. And then, as you just said, it then declares all these treaties null and void in 1871. I can only imagine this did irreparable damage to any lingering trust that remained between natives and, you know, anything the federal government was going to promise them going forward.
Yeah, of course. I mean, treaty making is such a important issue for Native nations. I think, so in 1871, I think the significance of that isn't so much in making all prior treaties sort of null. It's more a sense of no longer making any new treaties with Native nations. So this idea that, I guess in treaty making, it's important to understand that by making a treaty with a Native nation, whether it's colonial authority or federal government later on, showing an acceptance of that Native group as a nation, as another sovereign entity. And that's what makes treaties so important. So in that 1871 decision, you can kind of see the federal government shifting away from this, no longer wanting to accept Native groups as sovereign entities. But treaties are still today incredibly important, even though they haven't in some cases been ratified or haven't been fulfilled, the conditions haven't been fulfilled. Native nations still consider them an important sign of how they have at some point been accepted as a sovereign nation and use that as evidence of how they remain sovereign nations today. But in terms of the trust relationship between the federal government and Native nations, of course, that is incredibly damaging.
And then in 1887, we have something that I think is probably important to just highlight briefly, is the Dawes Act, which, you know, sort of looms large, certainly in my kind of limited understanding of the history, as an example of this late 19th century poor treatment of Native Americans. Could you explain what the Dawes Act is and why it is so devastating and so problematic?
Yeah, the Dawes Act is a change-making moment in terms of Native history. So, in essence, it's an attempt to impose the single family household on Native cultures that were often based on, you know, extensive kinship and clan networks, not necessarily this sort of head of household and his wife and children sort of idea. So with the Dawes Act, reservation lands, or communally held tribal lands were split into acres of 160, or split into allotments of 160 acres each. And then that would be given to each head of household, and they would have to, the idea was that they would establish a farm, and support their family off of that 160 acres. And then, after a certain period, those families would then gain American citizenship. So it's kind of a dual approach of both giving them sort of agricultural land and then transforming them into Americans through that process. Of course, in practice, what happened was that by separating those lands into 160 acres each, it left a lot of spare land open to white settlement. So actually, if we look at pre and post the allotment era in 1887, there were 138 million acres held tribally, communally by different Native nations. But by 1934, that had been reduced to just 48 million acres. So a huge amount of land lost.
Must have been accidental. Must have been accidental.
What a convenient coincidence. And at the same time, though, these weren't part of the Dawes Act, but they were propagated at that same era. Children were being sent to boarding schools, like, for instance, the Carlisle Indian School was established in 1879 with this idea of civilizing them by removing them from their families and essentially bringing them up to be white or whatever appropriate position they could hold in American society, usually kind of labor, cleaning, that kind of activity is what they were prepared for. And also there were cultural bans on practicing dances within those tribes because they were considered uncivilized or wasteful. For instance, if a dance, I think Sundance, for instance, among the Lakota can take several days, that was seen as time wasted from the agricultural pursuits that they were being encouraged to undertake.
Can I ask a quick follow-up on the issue of the land associated with the Dawes Act? Is this a deliberate process to deprive Native Americans of their land, or is it merely a convenient outcome of what the Dawes Act actually does?
It's kind of a bit of both. For instance, Dawes himself, when he's describing this act, he uses this idea of that we need to, I can't remember the exact quote, but he uses the words that we need to teach the American Indian selfishness, or that they lack the selfishness, the greed that that one needs to succeed in American society, essentially along those lines. So his argument is that this is helping American Indians by bringing them into society and teaching them that necessary, the wanting to, there's even this phrase of putting them out of the blanket into trousers where they have pockets that they can fill with money. So there is that sense, but I think the statistics are undeniable that it can't be an accident that vast expanse of land is opened up for white prospectors. And what land is opened up is generally the better land, the land that it might actually be feasible to have agricultural or have farms on, whereas the allotments given to those Native heads of household tended to be in poorer areas, perhaps, you know, not great soil. So when you look at the details in practice on sort of a tribal sort of case-by-case basis, you can really see how in practice, even if this big idea, this big theory was this great civilizing mission, in practice, on the ground, it seems much more like that it was a pursuit of land.
Okay, and obviously as a result of these actions and you know, many other factors going on, you see the rise of a lot of endemic poverty in the Native American experience as we move into the turn of the 20th century. And does the federal government, now that it's not viewing Native Americans as sovereign nations but trying to make them American, does it start to, you know, in essence, try to help their situation at all? Does it assume more responsibility around the sort of first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can see that assumption of responsibility in the assimilation era already, like taking on this mantle of we must civilize the native population. But certainly there is a recognition that allotment fails. Like it's undeniable that you know, American Indians do not turn into successful American farmers simply by being given a plot of land, or rather having a lot of land taken from them in exchange for a simple plot of land. And the federal government does recognize this to some extent. For instance, in 1928, the Merriam Report is released, which really studies the effects of allotment and shows that how much issues that has caused and how poverty is then affecting those areas. So there is certainly a concern about what to do with that situation that the government in itself has caused.
Could I mean, I'm interested in kind of this, the first half of the 20th century here, because in the 1930s, obviously, we have the Great Depression and, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deals that he puts forward to try and drag America out of it. And then in the middle of that, in 1934, you've got the Indian Reorganization Act, I think it's called. How are Native Americans involved in this, that, you know, the mass federal intervention in American society represented by the New Deals?
They're not so much brought into this idea of reshaping America. There are certainly Native activists who are trying to intervene in these definitions of what it is to be American and what it is to be Native within America. For instance, the Society of American Indians is formed in 1911, only manages to maintain an organization until 1923, but there are key figures like Charles Eastman and Zitkala Sah who are active in that period, who are boarding school educated, so have that background of having the government attempt to civilize them, and then still maintaining this struggle for Native rights despite that. In terms of the New Deal, there's a real shift, again, or an apparent shift, with federal government action. On the surface, it seems that the government's accepted that they're going to make a change, that they need to improve the situation. So, for instance, like you mentioned, Malcolm, the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act is made to establish tribal governments. They're trying to essentially saying that they're going to establish different tribal governments, and that will help those tribes self-govern and make their own decisions. In addition, there's day schools established on reservations instead of this boarding school system. And the Indian Arts and Crafts Board is also established to help promote and protect Native arts and crafts. So it seems like this is an attempt to really improve the situation of Native Americans. But when you scratch the surface, it's actually still a continuation of a very paternalist system and doesn't allow for much action from those tribes to maintain their own systems of governance, for instance, or their own cultures or lifestyles without that kind of Euro-American intervention into it. So, for instance, the Reorganization Act, the IRA, there was a draft constitution based on European parliamentary systems that was essentially imposed on those tribes that accepted it. So that was drafted before any consultation with tribes on what sorts of governments they might want to establish. And then in practice, when tribes were allowed to vote on whether to adopt the Indian Reorganization Act, absentee votes were counted as yeses, like something as simple as that. Of really, you could really see this strong will to impose it on tribes, and the reaction of those Native nations varies. Some do accept it and fare fairly well, but others, like for instance, the Navajo, well, what's now called the Navajo Nation, at the time was called the Navajo Tribe. They completely rejected it, despite all of these attempts to, you know, force acceptance through, for instance, the absentee yes votes and this sort of thing, or even things like arranging votes on days when there's a horrible storm or in places where people couldn't actually get to. And there are all sorts of accounts of that sort of attempt to really make it seem like they wanted this, but in practice, wasn't necessarily the case. Yeah.
It sounds really like, it really is, you know, echoes of the 1830s approach and everything, and you getting different, you know, chiefs to sign up to it while other ones were opposed to it but pretending they were the real ones and everything. It's interesting to see things hadn't changed much since the days of Andrew Jackson in terms of getting them to accept treaties. And I just have a sort of cultural question from this era, and I know that's not your focus, so if it's don't worry if this isn't something you know too much about, but it just occurs to me, obviously, the 1930s, 40s, you know, that's really when you see the rise of the Western, you know, was it, I think Stagecoach is one of the huge big hits in 1939 with John Wayne and everything, and obviously these Westerns do not depict Native Americans in kind terms until you get to the late 1960s or something when you start to get the odd one. How does that cultural depiction affect either Native Americans or just sort of how they begin? Is there a shift in how they're viewed because of that depiction, or was that there all along?
Actually, I think the history of Western films... Now, I can't remember which scholar argued this, but you can see sort of a shift according to U.S. foreign policy, what happens in Western films. For instance, like in that sort of wartime era, that kind of World War II era especially, you get a lot of Westerns where the American Indian is presented as this, like, very simple evil enemy that needs to be defeated, and that's kind of glorifying that American pursuit perhaps abroad, whereas then in sort of the Vietnam War era, where the war effort's far more criticized, Western films, you get things like Little Big Man and Soldier Blue, much more critical depictions of essentially just transposing this Vietnam situation into the Western, of like this victim narrative of they're all just being slaughtered by this horrible American force. So the image of how American Indians are used in U.S. popular culture, there's so many things that impact that. But because federal policy is so little known by the general public, there's so few people who are involved in making it in government as well. It tends to be certain individuals who are very interested or who have certain personal gain to be had through federal Indian policy that get involved. That actually, I don't think that the federal policy necessarily affects the depiction of Native Americans. I think there are other factors that are more important.
Moving into your era, from the 1950s onwards, and what researchers, as you mentioned, call the termination era. Before we get into it, can you explain exactly what scholars like yourself mean when you use that term?
Sure. Well, believe it or not, termination as a term comes from what Congress used at the time. So it, as horrible as it sounds, and some, I think it was the Blackfoot leader, Earl Oldperson, even reference, like in the Blackfoot language, there is no translation for termination. It just means the only way to translate it is just to kill, essentially, or to extinguish. So it really doesn't work as a term. But what what Congress meant by termination in the 1950s was terminating the federal trust status of American Indian tribes. So they don't mean like an actual termination, a kind of physical genocide, but rather just removing that separate legal status within the United States. So through federal trust status, whatever lands remained that were communally held or were reservations, they were protected from sale by that trust status, so that there were certain protections that kept those lands from being bought by white prospectors, for instance. It also meant that members of federally recognized tribes would gain services from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, like including health and education, so schools, hospitals, that sort of thing, were the responsibility of the government to provide for those tribes. So the idea of termination was that by removing all those things that made them separate, all the, as the government put it, disabilities and limitations, by removing those services and those protections, Native Americans would somehow magically transform into full American citizens and adopt their sort of place in U.S. society. So that was the idea of termination. In practice, it was an absolute disaster. For instance, well, it was carried out on a tribe-by-tribe basis, so it wasn't kind of a blanket policy that affected everyone. But for instance, the Klamath tribes in Oregon, their federal trust status was removed eventually in 1961, which meant in practice that most of their lands were lost. So most of that final remaining reservation was lost. And then through the loss of services and the psychological trauma of all this, all of that added up to the median age of death amongst Klamath tribal members dropping from what it was in 1961, 46 years, to just 39 and a half by 1971, which is quite a big drop in just 10 years. So real effects on people's lives.
Yeah. I was wondering as a follow-up to that, like, why now? Why in 1953? I mean, obviously this is sort of the beginning of the Eisenhower administration. It's just my own random theory, and you can shoot it down with what actually happened, but I was just wondering if it had anything to do with, you know, the sort of rise of bringing Christianity into government, you know, the whole sort of, you know, Kevin Cruz's One Nation Under God thing, and perhaps the Native Americans not being Christian and that being part of it, or was it just about an economic land grab?
That's an interesting point. I hadn't actually thought of that sort of Christianization sort of idea in this period. I think it certainly could be linked in the sense of wanting to unify the nation in terms of this creating this clear national identity or strengthening that. It's certainly linked to the Cold War. There were even some senators referring to reservations as communistic spaces, sort of hotbeds of communism because of that communal aspect. Even like things as ridiculous as conflating, you know, red communists with red Indians on U.S. soil. So that certainly played a part. There's also this impact of the Second World War with Native Americans being so heavily involved in that war effort. So there's a combination of reasons, really, of what motivates this. But I think that Cold War era sense of needing to unify the nation and get rid of this sense of any kind of separate status, it didn't fit into that idea anymore.
I now need to go away and look up in the congressional record who in Congress actually said that about the conflation of red communism and red Indians, because that is just completely insane.
I think it tended to be more in sort of campaign speeches and this sort of thing. When I've been looking into, or for instance, last summer when I was at the Eccles Center looking into the congressional record, there are some really shocking things that people say about Native Americans there.
Can I just quickly, can you identify who is saying these things? Who in the Senate or in the House of Representatives is?
Well, I think one of the classic terminationists is Arthur Watkins, who's Republican from Utah. Then there's E.Y. Berry is also a pretty key figure in the termination movement as well. I think those are the top two names that come to mind. Yeah.
That is genuinely remarkable. Anyway, so I mean, in your research, you've kind of compared the experiences of like two different tribes in this period and the kind of their dealings with the federal government, the Klamath and the Navajo. So, I mean, what are your investigations and your research into their responses to termination policies? What did that uncover about the responses of these two tribes to the policy of termination?
Well, what I tried to do in my research is to look at Native agency in this period rather than this kind of sort of victim narrative of termination was a disaster, but what kind of agency could those tribes practice within those sort of colonially imposed structures of tribal governments, which, as we learned earlier, are impositions of the Indian Reorganization Act or other actions following that to establish these kind of parliamentary governments within reservations. But in practice, the main difference between the Klamath and Navajo are that, as I mentioned, the Klamath were terminated. The Navajo were not. They weren't perceived by the government as ready. They were even categorized as predominantly Indian, whereas the Klamath were categorized as predominantly assimilated. So there were differing ideas on how ready they were to join the American public. But what my research shows is that the Klamath tried to use termination as a way to gain further self-government, because that's how they interpreted it initially. That's what this whole conversation was about, in termination, of freeing them to do what they wanted, is how they interpreted it, that they would then be able to control their government better. Unfortunately, as it became more apparent what termination would lead to, they then resisted it incredibly strongly, but were entirely ignored in Congress. They failed at repealing their Termination Act, though they did push it back two times. It was initially meant to be 1958. It was pushed back to 1961, for instance. The Navajo, today known as the Navajo Nation, they instead, though they weren't pegged for termination immediately, they used that language of a sort of social evolutionary language of themselves as preparing for eventual termination at some indeterminate point in the future, in order to gain social and economic programs and funding for their tribe, which they then in practice, in some cases, used to maintain their cultures and to support their peoples and their education. So they were able to kind of harness that language of developing for joining American society, instead to strengthen their own system of government and social services for their peoples.
So, I mean, we're in the era, in the 1950s and 60s, we're in this era of, you know, the classical or heroic era of the African-American civil rights movement. I mean, obviously we all know there's a much longer civil rights movement that goes back into the 19th century and up into the 21st century where we are now. How important is this, the atmosphere of civil rights to Native Americans? Are they involved? Does this spur anything within Native American communities to seek greater civil rights for themselves?
Yeah, certainly the methods, particularly of the civil rights movement, in terms of, for instance, sit-ins or occupations or that kind of like media, gaining media attention, that's certainly borrowed from both the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement by Native activists. But there's also a real concern about conflating the issues, both at the time and now when we talk about teaching the civil rights movement. We have to be very careful of presenting Native Americans as just tacked on to the classic kind of African-American civil rights movement idea. So what's happening with Native activists in that period is that they're using those methods like sit-ins, for instance, that's transformed in the Native context to fish-ins. So rather than sitting in a cafe, they're going to lakes where their treaty fishing rights are being denied and fishing there anyway, which leads to arrests, for police arrests, particularly in Washington state. This is a big event. The National Indian Youth Council becomes involved in it. They supporting different local tribes in trying to assert those fishing rights just by going and doing it. And then, of course, the famous occupation of Alcatraz. You know, that's a big, huge media stunt. But they're not looking for equality or in that sense. They're not looking for those same rights that everyone else has, which is what termination was claiming to provide. Instead, they're opposing that loss of their status as American Indian, their status as Indigenous. So the main issue for Native American activists at that point is protecting their treaty rights and protecting their sovereignty and self-determination and regaining some of that land and control that they had in the past.
And obviously the sort of the solid demonstrations that we see happening, and certainly the ones that have gone down in the history books, perhaps the most known one of the sort of Alcatraz proclamation, which we began this podcast with a clip from. And I was just wondering, since it was yourself that, you know, you recommended that we start the episode with the Alcatraz proclamation, what was it about that you think, you know, it's important for the viewers to have heard a snippet of?
I think the Alcatraz proclamation, obviously, I chose that partially because it's such a classic event, but also people don't really know that much about what was going on, just to kind of have a vague sense that there were American Indians who took over Alcatraz, and you know, you can still see the writing on the walls if you go visit the site. what I wanted to bring out there, I think it was actually inspired by the podcast you did with Ed last month, is that they're talking about some those similar issues, like what treaties have been broken, or he references, for instance, oh, we're going to pay you with beads and whatever for this island. So there's a sense of sarcasm, of kind of using that kind of sarcastic humor to point out the way that the government has been treating Native Americans, and to critique that. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when listening to the Alcatraz Proclamation, is that context, showing how, you know, we think about American Indians as, you know, Custer's last stand or colonial era, and not as part of the 20th century. So here is an American Indian man talking about treaty rights in 1969. I think that's why that proclamation is so important.
And, you know, we also, I mean, one of the other things which, you know, certainly I always think about, you know, when thinking about Native Americans in the 20th century is the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, the site of the horrific massacre of, you know, December 1890. What is the significance of the occupation of Wounded Knee, and does that, what does that have a catalytic effect? What does that do, or is it part of a wider series of kind of activist interventions in American life?
Well, Wounded Knee is quite a classic. Well, obviously another classic example. That's part of the American Indian movement specifically, which is one sort of branch of Native American activism, so to speak. So the American Indian movement has also been heavily criticized for a lot of reasons, but is of course important because of these very sort of media heavy protests. Wounded Knee obviously has that symbolic importance in being the site of the massacre. What people maybe don't know so much about Wounded Knee is that the occupation occurred there because of the actions of the tribal government, which was seen as kind of a puppet to sort of U.S. federal authorities just carrying out their wishes. So there's sort of a dual thing there of that symbolic aspect to the occupation, as well as addressing real issues on the ground of what was going on with that reservation.
So, given that these protests were taking place, I mean, how does the federal government actually respond to Native American activism? You know, we're obviously in just after the you know, the Great Society, very active government eras come in the middle of the 60s, and these sort of bigger, more symbolic events are coming just after that. I mean, does that affect how the government responds, or are they actually quite reactive and get quite heavily involved, even under, you know, the sort of Nixon administration?
Well, in terms of the protests, obviously there's quite a, you know, the FBI becomes involved. There's a real physical response, but in terms of more broadly federal government responses, in the 60s, it seems that particularly under the Johnson administration, Native Americans are kind of seen as like the easy case to deal with. So for instance, in 1968, the Indian Civil Rights Act is passed, which sounds great because it's a Civil Rights Act, but it's in some ways, by imposing the Bill of Rights over tribal governments, it again enforced this sort of U.S. authority over Native nations. So there's serious issues with that Civil Rights Act, and it was very heavily criticized by a lot of Native activists at the time. So I think the federal response in the 60s and it kind of echoes what the federal response always seems to be, is this attempt to fix these issues. But again, it's a kind of surface level solution. Nixon in the 70s, Nixon's actually considered one of the best presidents in terms of Native rights because of his Self-Determination Act, his denouncing of termination in 1970. He admits that it was a mistake, it was wrong, and that we should move towards self-determination for American Indian tribes. But the real Yeah, it's a very complex issue, so I don't want to get into too much detail about it. But when you pick apart the funding and the solutions that are offered, it doesn't offer a lasting solution to the issues with federal Indian relations.
Yeah. And I was just wondering how much are, as a quick follow-up to that, how many Native Americans have served in important positions in the federal government? Like, you know, is of the government perhaps, did at any point they realize that perhaps one of the reasons a lot of their plans were failing was because they were white people, you know, white Anglo-Saxons, you know, designing prescriptions for Native American tribes? And did they attempt to bring in voices that would have known more?
Well, the first head of the, as it was then known, Office of Indian Affairs, was Eli S. Parker, who is obviously a close associate of Ulysses S. Grant. So that's way back in sort of the mid-1800s. I can't remember the exact years. But the next head of then, the name has changed to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, doesn't come until the 1960s. So you've got a huge gap where there isn't a native person leading that. And then in the 1960s, the next native head of the BIA is Robert Bennett, who is a NADA. But he had been involved in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in sort of lesser positions pretty much throughout his career. So the tendency is when Native individuals are gain these positions is that they've worked within the federal government for quite a long time. So they're not necessarily bringing in any kind of radical change when they do get in those positions. And, you know, whatever the BIA does, it's still restricted by what the federal government determines as Indian policy. So they still have to fulfill those requirements. So having more Native people work in the BIA is one of the changes in the 1970s. It's one of the aims that Nixon's Indian policy introduces, but in practice, it's limited as to how much that can actually change when it's still working within that same structure.
And kind of taking the story forward from the 1970s into the 80s and 90s, and perhaps even into the, you know, the 21st, you know, century, how does Native American activism proceed after the 1970s? I mean, where does it go, and how does it link into kind of how does it link into environmentalism? Because I'm thinking of the Standing Rock protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline in very, very recent memory. So, you know, what's the kind of, and is there success achieved for Native Americans in terms of kind of negotiating with the federal government and, you know, gaining access to lands and all that kind of thing? How do things transpire?
Well, there's certainly important developments, for instance, with the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, for instance, in, I think it was 86, of a recognition of, you know, things need to change with the Repatriation Act. It's in terms of, for instance, repatriating artifacts in museums that were taken from Native nations and returning. The idea is that act should help return them to those cultures and to their uses, and or for instance, most obviously, for instance, with remains of ancestors, of allowing those tribes to then put them to rest in whatever way is appropriate to them. Native activism in this kind of very public form of the American Indian movement seems to kind of, I don't want to say weaken, but it kind of dies out towards the early 80s, and there isn't kind of this sense of a really big media heavy or attention attracting movement until really Standing Rock is the pinnacle now of like modern day Native activism. In terms of the federal government and Native Americans, I think the Obama administration is a really important period. There's not so much no, there are developments in the 90s, but not so much as when Obama comes into office and he really promises to make a change and to have a real relationship with American Indian tribes. And for instance, he sets up the White House Tribal Nations Conference, which he holds every year to meet with Native leaders and to talk through those issues. He also gets a lot of funding programs through to develop things like internet access on reservations and really some of that makes real tangible change. But the problem is that this is so dependent on administration. So obviously now that Trump is in office, this has all been forgotten. There was no announcement even made that the White House Tribal Nations Conference wasn't going to be held. It just didn't happen. So I think that's the real issue. And when we talk about settler colonialism, that this control and this paternalism that the U.S. government has over Native nations, it's not really, you know, there isn't space for them to make lasting change when it's so dependent on the whims of each specific administration. It seems that there's very little that can be done within that structure.
And I mean, I think this connects into kind of a broader understanding of the history of Native Americans and Native America. Because when I'm teaching I teach a single semester, very broad U.S. history survey course that goes from the colonial era right the way up to the 20th century. So it's trying to cram in a huge amount of history. And I will admit myself, I tend to touch really rather lightly on Native American issues beyond the Jacksonian era, the Indian Removal Act, the Trail of Tears, and so on. And then the post-Civil War period of the post-Civil War 1860s treaties, and then the Indian Wars era up to Wounded Knee. So how do you think that educators at all levels, I mean, whether in schools or universities or colleges, can more successfully integrate Native American histories into the lecture theatre or the classroom? Because that's something I find a particular challenge.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. I think that's sort of part of the issue in how Native people are viewed today within the U.S. and abroad all over the world, is sort of this, still this sense that they barely exist. Like Standing Rock kind of disrupted that idea by presenting Native Americans as like, we're still here and we have these global alliances with Indigenous peoples all over the globe to help support in opposing that pipeline. But I think the thing to remember is how important it is to remind students that Native Americans still exist. So that's one reason, or I guess that's a reason to bring them into the classroom rather than an explanation of how. But I think, for instance, in terms of thinking of what the United States is, how it's formed, what it's based on. You know, there is no United States without American Indians. So it's really important to bring in those moments. And, for instance, getting students to read primary sources by Native Americans, like, for instance, this, Richard Oakes's Alcatraz Proclamation, or, there's some great primary source collections, from different periods. For instance, Daniel Cobb's Say We Are Nations collection has a lot of primary sources packed in, so you could integrate, American Indian speeches from, for instance, the New Deal era or related to civil rights, explaining how Native activists' aims are different to the aims of civil rights activists, for instance. So there are different ways of doing it. I can appreciate, obviously, you know, it's difficult to bring Native Americans in when you're doing a broad U.S. history survey course, just like I've found it's quite difficult to cover the whole of Native American history in an hour-long podcast or 19th, 20th century history. But I think you just need to remember how important it is in terms of thinking about what the United States is as a country, what its aims are, what the values are, questioning those ideas of what freedom is, what equality looks like, and how that can be varied. You know, using Native or bringing in Native perspectives really complicates those preconceptions that students and we as teachers and educators have.
Yeah. So I've got one final question for you, Retta. So sort of the image in many ways in American society today of the Native American. I remember I had a couple of students in a class before, and they both lived near Indian reservations in different states. They weren't, I think they were on the East Coast, actually. And they had this very negative view of Native Americans, like, you know, poverty, casinos, drugs, the whole kind of thing and everything. And you know, there are high poverty rates there and everything. And one of the themes of your and Ed's works, both of you, that you've talked about, and you hinted at earlier, is this theme of giving Native Americans their agency back and not just giving, not being seen as victims of the past 200, 300 years or even further back of European settlement in the Americas. But to what extent does it have to be, do you deal with also acknowledging the limits of that? Because in essence, you know, the Americans came with the guns and, you know, the disease that, you know, at first, and then also then an era we've talked about today, the federal government is so much more powerful than any, all of the tribes together combined, even if they acted as one. So how do you sort of deal with sort of balancing giving them agency back and saying these were humans who had their own decisions to make, and but the fact that they were not the ones who held the power?
I think first off, I kind of have to slightly push against this idea of giving them their agency back, because I think it's more an idea of bringing out the agency they always had, and that was already there. And I think, yes, certainly, I think in getting away from that idea of how overpowering the United States or other sort of national governments are over Indigenous people, it's so important to read Indigenous scholars and get to their ideas of Native cultures and what role they play. Like, for instance, there's the work of Philip DeLoria in terms of like playing Indian and what that notion of American Indians, what role that plays throughout U.S. history. And Donald Fixico, who works on 20th century Native American history broadly, and also in terms of conceptions of what history is and what time is in the Native American mind compared to the U.S. context or American sort of culture. Kind of bringing in those different perspectives can really change how we think about U.S. history as not necessarily just this kind of linear victim narrative when it comes to American Indians.
And I think that is an entirely appropriate place to conclude. That was, as we always say, that was fascinating. That's become our kind of thing. But it always is. And one thing I've taken from this is not only learning from your research and your knowledge, but also I'm delivering a lecture on the 1970s in America in a week's time. And I'm now going to go back and change my lecture to include more about Native American activism, about Wounded Knee, and even going to, you know, Alcatraz and all that kind of thing. So that's already changed my teaching, which can only be a good thing, I think, if only to highlight in a small way the continued kind of agency and prominence and significance of Native Americans in the history of the United States. So thank you so much for that, Rita. That was absolutely fascinating and incredibly, as always, I'll always learn so much from these podcasts, and that was absolutely no exception.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was great to talk to you guys. Yep.
So we'll be back next month, as always, and we're going to be taking perhaps a sharp right turn, and we're going to be talking about the war on drugs next month even. So until then, thank you very much again, both, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.